Hello and welcome. It is Eric Erickson here, the Eric Erickson Show across the nation. The phone number is 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. You know what time it is? You know what time we need to get ready for?
Gloom, despair, and agony on me. Deep, dark depression, excessive misery. If it weren't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all. Gloom, despair, and agony on me.
I stand 6'8" when I'm completely unfurled. And to find a mate, I've looked all over this world.
Then a store downtown advertised everything for us tall guys.
And they had everything except tall girls.
Gloom, despair, and agony on me. Deep, dark depression, excessive misery. If it weren't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all. Gloom, despair, and agony on me.
Doom, despair, and agony. It is time for the climate summit with the United Nations. That's right, boys and girls. We're about to be inundated, indoctrinated, and badgered into giving up our entire Western way of life so that Greta Thunberg stops scowling at us. Where is she? I haven't seen her in the news yet. It's only a matter of time before she comes back. The Biden administration rolling out their global warming plans, their Green New Deal. Here's the president.
Today, one of every three Americans lives in a city or a state transitioning to clean energy, clean energy electricity. But folks, we have to pick up the pace. When I rejoined the Paris Climate Accord after we had been pulled out of it, the goal set when our last administration, the Obama-Biden administration, when that was set, they were set that we had more time. We don't have the time now. The goals are different because the necessity is there. We don't have a lot of time. We don't have much more than 10 years, for real.
Don't have more than 10. Now, wait a second. Now, 2 years ago, they said we only had 10 years and we've still got 10 years. We put it on pause for some. What is going on here? Congressional Democrats are calling top executives at ExxonMobil and other oil giants to testify at a House hearing as lawmakers investigate what they say is a long-running industry-wide campaign to spread disinformation about the role of fossil fuels in causing global warming. The House Oversight Committee on Thursday requested executives at ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, and Shell testify at a hearing next month, along with leaders of the American Petroleum Institute, the oil industry's top lobbying group, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Carolyn Maloney and Ro Khanna, Democrats, demand them come. They write in a letter, "We are deeply concerned that the fossil fuel industry has reaped massive profits for decades while contributing to climate change that is devastating American communities, costing taxpayers billions of dollars, and ravaging the natural world." Meanwhile, in Europe, as I mentioned yesterday, cold weather is predicted for Europe this winter. The U.S. is warning Europe they haven't done enough to build up what? Fossil fuel reserves. Why? Because it turns out their rush for green power isn't actually helping them. If anything, it's hurting them. Why? Because their green weather isn't, or their green energy producers can't keep up with the demand. There's just not enough. It's not working for them. Meanwhile, there's this. This happened a short time ago. You got to listen to this audio here. This is kind of unbelievable. Nancy Pelosi, in a conversation about dealing with China. Listen, this is the Speaker of the House of the United States.
We've always felt connected to China. But with their military aggression in the South China Sea, with their continuation of genocide with the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province there with their violation of the cultural, linguistic, religious priority of Tibet, with their suppression of democracy in Hong Kong and other parts of China as well. They're just getting worse in terms of suppression and freedom of speech. So that militarily, so human rights, security, economically. Having said all of that, and again, I go back and forth to China, I've been there a number of times. Sometimes I'm considered the most unpopular person in China, or sometimes the most unpopular American in China, which I wear with a badge of honor because, and again, I have my relationships there because we've been fighting a long time. But we have to work together on climate. Climate is an overriding issue. And China is the leading emitter in the world, U.S. too, developed world too, but we must work together. So we have to have a level of communication on whether it's COVID, whether it's terrorism, whether it's climate. We still have to have some communication and dialogue with China on that.
I don't know which group Nancy Pelosi was speaking to here as an academic setting, but the Speaker of the House of Representatives of the United States, in answering a question, says China has committed genocide against the Uyghurs. It has been military aggressive in the South China Sea and with its neighbors. It has suppressed freedom in Hong Kong. It suppresses freedom in the mainland. It is engaged in genocide. It hurts people who want to practice religion. It's hostile to people of faith. But we got to work with them on climate change. In her words, climate change is overriding. My question is, how can you trust them? Take her at the very basic level. They're terrible people, but we have to work with them. Okay, but how do you trust them? Now, Pelosi wants to say that the United States is as big an emitter of carbon emissions, of global warming emissions as China. And that's not actually true. Maybe the Western world together with China, but then you also have India, you got Russia, you got Brazil. But there's not really an equating here. And the larger issue here, and this is the problem for the Democrats, really, it's the problem for the environmentalist movement as a whole. How do you engage in meaningful reform for climate change? Let's just assume for sake of argument, there's a legitimate reason to tackle climate change. Just assume for sake of argument, there's a legitimate reason. How do you work with a ruthless rogue regime that runs concentration camps and is determined to be the dominant force on the planet and is essentially building multiple fossil fuel burning power plants every year, and yet they say they're going to be compliant? How do you deal with them, work with them, and cooperate with them when they don't keep their promises? If you want to solve the global warming problem, unless you transition so quickly to be carbon neutral that you then seed the way for them to be dominant. This is part of the problem we have to deal with as Western society, as secular Westerners embrace climate change as the most important issue of all time. As the president of the United States says, we have a decade as they build in calls of crisis, as they demand that we give up our SUVs, as we shutter coal-burning power plants and put people out of work, all in the name of solving the problems of the world, the global warming problems. You're dealing with a country, China, that emits far more than us, and does so because it's cheaper than the alternatives. we require solar panels that they use slave labor to make, and the Biden administration has now largely clamped down on our ability to do to import those. How can you come to a solution? Rupert Darwell in The Spectator has a piece. Let me read some of it for you. The West's humiliation in Afghanistan has an older brother, climate change. As siblings, the two share characteristics, most obviously an inability to confront unwelcome facts. In Afghanistan, there was a large constituency led by the Pentagon invested in the mantra of proclaiming progress in the fight against the Taliban. Climate has its own industrial complex of NGOs, climate scientists, renewable energy lobbyists profiting from the energy transition, eager helpers in the media, and the politicians posing as world saviors. Energy experts tell us renewable energy is cheaper than building new fossil fuel power stations. If they're right, why did China build the equivalent of more than one large coal plant a week last year? I said a month is a week. Its slave labor camps help produce materials for Chinese solar panels, which make them the cheapest in the world. This led the Biden administration to ban their importation. In 10 years, India, a country more susceptible to Western fads, increased the amount of energy or electricity generated from coal nearly six times faster than from wind and solar. In 2020, fossil fuels accounted for almost 90% of India's primary energy consumption. These facts help explain the biggest fact of all. The first 20 years after the 1992 United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change saw carbon dioxide emissions rise 60%. From 2012 to 2019, they rose a further 5.4%. However, this is dressed up. It's failure. Meanwhile, the West's energy emissions have been more or less flat for nearly three decades and on a downward trend since 2007. Emissions from the rest of the world account for all the growth in global emissions, suddenly accelerating in 2002 from an average of around 1% a year to nearly 5% a year in the 12 years until 2014. As a matter of simple arithmetic, the West's declining share of global emissions means that whatever it does or doesn't do is of diminishing relevance to the future of climate change. The West's solipsism of we, as in we must act, is a profound self-deception. It's true. We, the people of the West, have been reducing our emissions while China and India have been increasing theirs. So what do we do? Do we go back to the Stone Age to offset China and India? That's what I think some environmentalists would prefer us to do. I think that's what some of them want us to do, but it becomes a national security issue. It's not going to work and it's not sustainable. And they don't want to acknowledge it. They don't want to admit it. And we can't change China and India. And China knows this. And again, I said China was building a coal power plant a month. This corrects me. It's a coal powered plant a week. It's coming online in China. What do environmentalists want to do? Now, this gets back to the woke kids of TikTok, the libs of TikTok. The girl who believes that the adoption system in the United States is colonialist. When you have people in the West who believe that anything the West wants is colonialism and is bullying, where in the secular religion of the left does this conflict with their environmental policies? Because, you know, you've got this growing body of people on the left who say we can't impose our values on anyone else. So if we can't impose our values on anyone else, but those people are the polluters who are driving up the emissions on the planet, what do you do? Do you take one for the team and force your own society back into the Stone Age? There's no political will for that. Or do you try to impose your Western values on them? Well, there's no political will for that on the left, so what do? Nothing. That's the answer. Nothing. What you get is theater without any resolution of the issue. These people who so profoundly expect us to solve climate change, we have less than a decade, they say, to do it. You can't, because you're not willing to engage China and India, because to do so would be colonialism. You can't do it. All you can do is make your own people suffer, and your people will cause a backlash if you do. So good luck with that. Hello and welcome. It is Eric Erickson here. The phone number is 877-973-7425. Let's go to the phones. I'm going to go first to Maggie. Welcome to the program, Maggie.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a seasoned citizen. I'm from the generation where your word was your bond, and you always acted upon the courage of your convictions. So if we are to believe that Austin, Milley, and Blinken told Biden that his plan was suicide not to do it, and they did nothing, they didn't say, Mr. President, if you go ahead with this, please accept my resignation because I can't live with your decision. And I all have to take my hat off to the two servicemen, the 17-year Marine soldier who posted a Facebook comment, and I also read about a 19-year serviceman, both of them resigning because of not only the situation in Afghanistan, but also the required mandates for vaccines in the military. So, I mean, wokeness and yeah. political correctness have removed courage of conviction from our vocabulary.
That is so well said, Maggie. Thank you very much for the phone call. It's true. And they should have stood up. They should have. But, you know, a lot of these guys, they like their position of power. Milley seems to very much like being the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and would never consider resigning. Frank in Whispering Pines, North Carolina, you're going to be up next. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Eric. Nice to talk to you finally. Hey, just a real quick background about myself. A long time ago, I got an undergraduate degree in physics, and at the time, at the end of my undergraduate degree, I was actually working with computer sciences and climate science, but I kind of let that go a long time ago. But recently, I've been reading a book by Stephen Conan called Unsettled. He was the undersecretary for science and energy under the Obama administration. So not exactly a conservative, so
right.
to speak. But, you know, through that book, he's basically claiming that, you know, everything that they claim about, whether it's the fires, the floods, or the hurricanes, or the tornadoes, there's really no indication that there's been any conceivable change, measurable change in the frequencies and intensity mm-hmm. of those over the last 50 years. Plus, even going back, you know, we have maybe 150 years of very valid records, if even that is good, compared to, you know, a planet that has mankind on it for 10 to, you know, 20,000 years. Long term, there's, you know, they basically just don't really know. And it's just this whole thing is just a scam to, you know, basically turn the United States into an energy an energy decline country, and, you know, you completely eliminate all the fossil fuels in the United States, like you talked about, the climate and the coal fired from China and India would still be doing whatever it's going to do.
Yeah, look, you're right. And I this goes back to my long-term statement, and Frank, thanks very much for the phone call, that a lot of the environmentalists right now, they used to be the anti-American, anti-capitalist people, called watermelons. They're red on the inside, green on the outside. They want to destroy Western capitalism. They don't actually want to solve the climate problem. They just go through climate hysteria, get more grants, and work to undermine capitalism. Coming up at the top of the hour, the governor of the great state of Georgia is going to join me. He's helping rally governors around the nation to fight back against the vaccine mandate from the Biden administration, and also local officials in his own state who are trying to force people to get the vaccine. I'll talk to him about that, and Lila Rose as well from Live Action. Right now, I want to go back to the phones. I'm going to go to Joseph. You are going to be up next. Welcome. Joseph?
Hello?
Hi there.
Hello?
Hi, Joseph. You're on the air.
Hello? Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I was getting off the Bluetooth just for you. I was having a question about how does Stacey Abrams have a political action committee or whatever you want to call it, nonprofit, and still use those funds for gubernatorial aspirations? I thought there was a conflict of interest.
Yeah, well, it should be. So election law allows her a level of loophole here because she's not technically right now a candidate for office. So she can be in charge of this 501c3 that runs political education. Now, keep in mind here, a 501c3 can't actually run a political campaign. What it can do is it can do voter education. 501c3s on the left and the right do voter education. There's a fine line between politicizing and voter education. It's like pornography. They know it when they see it at the IRS, and they tend to see it more when the right does it than when the left does it. But when she becomes a candidate, she would have to step aside. Now, I gotta say this. I've actually had more and more people, Democrats and Republicans in Georgia, begin speculating that Stacey Abrams won't run for governor in 2022. And the reason being is because where Joe Biden's polling is right now, and given the swing back to the GOP in the suburbs, they don't see that Abrams has a path to victory. So right now there's a lady in Georgia. She's a state Senate Democrat who's running now for state attorney general named Jen Jordan. The speculation is that they will jump her into the governor's race on the Democratic side. So Abrams doesn't have to take the loss, but I still think she runs. I think Abrams runs for governor because she wants to run for president. She's been very open about that. And let's just follow along here. So let's say you pivot, you get a different Democrat to run against Brian Kemp in 2022. That person happens to win miraculously and gets reelected. That puts Abrams out 8 years. She's got to get elected to something. Does she run for the U.S. Congress instead? Does she try to run in a reconfigured district? There's a rumor that Georgia Congressman David Scott is going to step aside due to poor health once redistricting announced. And the rumor from the Democrats is that Congresswoman Lucy McBath, who's in the Northern District of Atlanta, is going to jump down into David Scott's seat because she believes the Republicans are going to rewrite her seat. Do they write a seat instead where you get a Congresswoman Abrams instead of a Governor Abrams, and the Congresswoman Abrams runs everything? I've heard from multiple Democrats now that she's kind of aligning people to run for particular offices. One state Senate Democrat told me he wanted to run for a particular seat, and she said, no, you're going to run for this other seat instead. So he is. She's calling the shots in Georgia. Now, all of this, of course, goes to an interview that Stacey Abrams gave where she wants to be president of the United States. Let's play this to 2024. 2024, you get Joe Biden not running again. Kamala Harris wants to run. Kamala Harris is not popular with progressives, and she's not popular with the establishment, and she couldn't even make it to Iowa in 2020. Biden may try to rally around her, but will he really? It's not like Barack Obama rallied around him. It's not like Ronald Reagan rallied around George H.W. Bush or Bill Clinton rallied around Al Gore or the like. Typically, incumbent presidents don't plant their flag and say, yes, my vice president succeeds me. It also typically doesn't help their vice president when the president does that. So what if Abrams wanted to challenge her as the uniter between the progressives and the establishment? She's been working on doing that. Well, she can unless she's gotten herself elected to something. It's really hard to go from being a state house member in Georgia to being president of the United States without getting yourself elected like governor at least. So I still think she runs because it otherwise puts her too far out on the calendar. But here's the thing, with Biden's popularity waning, I mean, Democrats are already, they are hoping against hope that Herschel Walker is the Republican nominee in Georgia, because they and a lot of Republicans, frankly, are convinced that Walker is more beatable than a Gary Black or a Latham Sadler. Kelvin King, who's one of the other Senate candidates in Georgia, he's not very well known, doesn't have a lot of statewide name ID. And so Republicans, though, they're worried. Republicans in Georgia, frankly, and in Washington are worried about Herschel Walker. Now, this isn't, don't perceive this as me going after Walker or not. I'm just reflecting to you what the people in Washington and in Atlanta tell me. They're worried about the baggage that Walker brings to the table, that the Democrats will eviscerate him with help of the media, you still got to get a lot of independent voters to turn out and vote. You can't do it with the Republican base alone in Georgia, and they're just afraid that Walker is kind of damaged goods with his background and with the opposition research, and that Warnock will be merciless while coming off as the happy, jovial guy. They're seeing Warnock in Georgia on the decline, and they're seeing right now, if the election were held today, the Republican primary, Herschel Walker would run away with it. Someone's got to devote a whole lot of money in the Republican primary to just annihilating Herschel Walker, or he's going to win. And Republicans are wondering right now if they can stop him. I don't know that they can. Walker is a likable, affable guy. He's got a track record as being a UGA hero. UGA is the most popular university in Georgia. He's got a ton of support. And a lot of people don't know the background. The problem is what happens in the general election, and that's the concern for the GOP. In fact, I was on television last night and was saying that one of the problems the GOP has to contend with is the Trump vetting process. Like, there are rumors afoot in Georgia that President Trump is still trying to find someone to run against Brian Kemp and is thus far not having a lot of luck. I am told that both of the Purdue, Sonny Perdue, the former agriculture secretary for Donald Trump, and David Perdue, the former U.S. senator, have encouraged Trump to move on and stop trying to find someone to take on Kemp, because there's a growing worry about the Democratic machine in Georgia. It seems to have finally found its stride, and Kemp should be able to win re-election against with a deeply unpopular incumbent Democratic president, but nobody wants to take any chances in Georgia right now. And Trump trying to find someone to sabotage Kemp could ultimately help a Stacey Abrams get elected. That's part of the problem. And likewise, he could maintain Warnock for another 6 years in the Senate by pushing Walker, unless Walker really gets on his A game. Now, he's starting to make personal appearances, and people will know very quickly whether or not he's up to snuff as a candidate. It's going to be a little bit hard for him to get out there. It's not something he's done before, but he's got to do it. Now, around the nation, Republicans have these problems. They're concerned in Arizona as well. Why? Well, because in Arizona, the state attorney general appears to be on track to run for the U.S. Senate. Peter Thiel has thrown someone into the race. I'm a little bit skeptical of Thiel getting involved in some of these campaigns, but Thiel's running a guy there. He's running J.D. Vance in Ohio. And then you've got another person who is vying for Trump's endorsement, I think already has gotten it, versus the attorney general in the state of Arizona, who has run statewide, has a statewide machine, and got a huge win against the left in the U.S. Supreme Court on the voting rights issue. He's been a popular attorney general. You got to be able to beat Mark Kelly in Arizona and Raphael Warnock in Georgia and Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire to take back the United States Senate. If you don't take those three seats back from the Democrats, you cannot win back the United States Senate. The math does not work for you. The Democrats have a real play in Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania, two states that Joe Biden won. Thankfully, they've got a good candidate running in Pennsylvania. Ron Johnson may be a fairly flawed candidate in Wisconsin to be able to run, and Republicans think they got a real shot if they can thread the needle. And their big concern right now is President Trump's endorsement of candidates who say wonderful things to Donald Trump and nurse his ego, but then don't relate to voters in those swing states. And you have to acknowledge, unless you totally buy into the stolen election mythology, that Georgia has shifted a little bit towards the Democrats, as has Arizona, and you got to have Republican candidates who can navigate that changed battleground status. I think the GOP is struggling right now with President Trump trying to be kingmaker, and they're going to have to find a way to come to terms with that. They're also going to have to find a way to come to terms with the debt ceiling increase. They're trying to shame Mitch McConnell. The Democrats are. I don't know that this is going to work. This is from the New York Times today. With the government's full faith and credit on the line, the Democratic leadership strategy for raising the federal borrowing limit seems to be this: try to shame the impervious Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky into capitulating. They unsuccessfully tried this strategy in 2016 when Mr. McConnell blockaded the nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court, maintaining that voters should decide who would name the next justice when they picked a president. They tried and failed again late last year, weeks before a presidential election, when the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg opened a Supreme Court seat for Amy Coney Barrett to fill. Now, with a potential government default weeks away, Democrats are again demanding Mr. McConnell back down, this time from his vow to lead Republicans in opposition to raising the statutory limit on the Treasury Department's authority to borrow. Let's be clear, McConnell wrote on Twitter Wednesday, with a Democratic president, a Democratic House, and a Democratic Senate, Democrats have every tool they need to raise the debt limit. It is their sole responsibility. Republicans will not facilitate another reckless partisan taxing spending spree. While Democratic attention is largely focused on passing a 10-year, $3.5 trillion social policy bill, notice they're no longer calling it infrastructure, even in the New York Times. A potentially more consequential deadline is rapidly approaching. Sometime in October, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has told Congress her ability to shuffle money from government account will be exhausted. The Treasury will no longer be able to pay all the nation's creditors unless Congress raises or suspends the limit on issuing debt. A default would be unprecedented, and it would lead to a far-reaching financial crisis, or at least a crisis in confidence for the government, banks, and other creditors that keep the federal government afloat by purchasing its bonds and notes. But Mr. McConnell is adamant that if Democrats insist on spending trillions on infrastructure, climate change, and social welfare, they bear the exclusive responsibility of raising the borrowing limit. And he's not wrong. This is essentially a high-stakes game of chicken in Washington, D.C., and Mitch McConnell has a history of winning the game of chicken. But here's the other thing. This is something you've got to understand here. Default is a choice. There's enough money that flows in on a monthly basis to the federal coffers that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen could choose to pay the debts of the United States and not other things. She's trying to claim that you aren't able to pay the debt, but that's not really true. You can pay the debt. There are other financial obligations of the country that aren't part of that debt that you couldn't pay in order to maintain the debt payment, service the debt. It's entirely possible for them to be able to do that, but they're trying to pretend it's not. McConnell and the Republicans aren't going to fall for this. In fact, Susan Collins, who they predicted would be a swing vote here, says, this is her quote, it's going to be entirely determined by the Democrats. They're the ones whose actions are making the increase in the debt limit necessary. By them moving forward with their $3.5 trillion package, in addition to the $1.5 trillion bipartisan infrastructure package, $5 trillion total, they're the ones who are necessitating us getting close to the limit for the debt ceiling. And it's something the Republicans have decided they're not going to humor the Democrats on. The Democrats have every ability to roll it into their reconciliation plan. They've chosen to refuse to do that. And in refusing to do that, well, they're the ones who are causing all the problems. So I dare them to try to get McConnell to cave. I don't think he will. And I think deep down they know it, and they're hoping that it'll set about a financial crisis they can blame the Republicans for. I don't think they'll be able to blame the Republicans for it. People are watching. People are seeing their big spending. It's even bigger spending than what the Republicans did. Now, I want you to save money. I want you to save money by going to Patriot Mobile and save money by making them your cell phone carrier. They are a Christian, conservative cell phone carrier. And I love them. They're great. The people who work there are great. And they're 100% U.S.-based customer service. So you can port your current phone number over. You can use your unlocked cell phone or get a cell phone from them. And they give a portion of their profits to pro-life causes, Second Amendment causes, first responder causes, veterans causes, and in fact have great discounts for veterans, first responders. And if you got a large household with multiple lines, they got discounts for you as well. What you do is go to patriotmobile.com/Eric. That's patriotmobile.com/ERIC. And you roll over. You get free activation by using my name, Eric. You can also call them 972-PATRIOT. Talk to their U.S.-based customer service. Tell them Eric sent you. You'll get free activation. Go to patriotmobile.com/Eric or call 972-PATRIOT. All right. I'm going to send out a recipe here in just a little while. If you want it, text the word recipe to 33777. You'll get a link back. You can sign up for the email list, but also you can go through and see the recipes that are there. I got to post it here in just a little bit. I'm reminded this by this ridiculousness. You know what the James Beard Award is? James Beard Award is the preeminent award for restaurants and food media. And it's like getting a Michelin star for your restaurant, except you, the chef, win the James Beard Award. And they've gone super woke. For the first time, winning James Beard Awards, long known as the top honors of the restaurant and food media world, won't depend on someone's skill with a whisk or with words. The organization that doles out the annual award has retooled its criteria and now will also base decisions on whether candidates have shown a demonstrated commitment to racial and gender equity, community, environmental sustainability, and a culture where all can thrive. The James Beard Foundation, which administers the awards, also announced a slate of other changes aimed at diversifying its judging committees and screening for potentially problematic chefs. That's right. If you're a chef and you're on social media and you're a conservative, the James Beard Award will not be coming to you. It's somewhat absurd. They're also getting rid of the age limit on the Rising Star Chef and renaming it the Emerging Chef because they need more diversity there. But there's a problem. A lot of people, particular minority chefs, are criticizing this because they say it you're supposed to be focusing on your restaurant. And if you've got the budget to do all of this stuff, you got to be probably a rich white guy with good investors, and you're not going to be honoring the people who are the good chefs. So there's no winning here. If you're a poor up and coming chef, you got to take the time to fight social justice while also running your restaurant. It's probably not going to work well. The change might put some restaurants at a disadvantage, according to the Washington Post. According to Hannah Raskin, a longtime food writer, she says better-funded restaurants might find it easier to run a recycling program, and restaurants that publicly espouse a social justice mission might be rewarded in some communities but penalized in others. Pathetic.